I'm Barry Gaudreau, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
Make me a deal and make it good for me. I won't get full of myself, I can't afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me today in the Zoom room, guitarist extraordinaire. You may know him best as a member of the band Boston, but he also has many other projects besides that group. He's got a self-titled solo album from 1980. He's got a band called Orion the Hunter, also from the 80s, and another band called RTZ. He's with us right now, and I can't wait to chat with Mr. Barry Gaudreau. Barry, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. By the way, my current band is Barry Gaudreau's Engine Room.
Barry Gaudreau's Engine Room?
That's right.
Who's in the band? Tell us about it.
Brian Mace is the lead singer keyboard player. Brian played keys in the Orion Hunter band back in the 80s and was also a member of RTZ, along with Tim Archibald. They've been with me now ever since the RTZ band back in 91.
So are you guys all New England, Boston-based musicians?
Yeah, I live, 20 minutes outside of town in the suburbs, and all the other guys are local.
You seem to work with the same group of guys. You find some guys that you obviously get along with personally. I'm sure that's number one, because you got to hang out with each other.
That's always important, sure.
And then they're also stellar musicians. So you get the best of both worlds. So I'm glad that you found these guys and that you're still working together.
Well, you find good people, you stick with them.
That's for sure.
The better the people around you are, the better it makes you look.
By the way, you look fantastic.
Not bad for an old guy.
Yeah,
huh?
Seriously.
Hair's a little white, but,
Look,
still have some.
The hair's a little white, but that's right, you still have it. I'd rather have a head full of gray hair than no hair. So good for you, Barry. So, Barry, what's the new album called?
You know, it's called The Road. It's actually the second record we've done with the Engine Room. The first one was Full Steam Ahead. And that record was kind of blues-based, where this record's a straight-ahead rock record. I was kind of looking back to my rock roots, early 70s kind of rock, the kind of stuff that I was listening to before Boston took off.
Love Will Lead the Way.
Yeah.
Had a great 70s, 80s rock vibe. And then the other track, The Road, to me, had a little bit of a country tinge to it, kind of.
Yeah, the verse, I guess you could say that has kind of a country tinge to it. But once you get to the guitar solo, look out.
And this album's coming out when? What's the date?
March 19th.
March 19th. So you guys can, if you're listening to this right now, you can go out and buy that thing right now. I assume on your website, barrygaudreau.com, and all digital media outlets.
Yes. Yeah. It'll be, you can go to the website to purchase a physical copy, or it'll be, on iTunes and all the other digital marketplaces.
Now, for you, the artist, it's best if we go to your website and buy it, correct? Is that where you...
Yes. You know, for me, back in, I remember the album days when you bought the album and you sat and you looked at it and looked at the pitches and read all the notes. And, you know, I don't think people are into that as much now, especially with the CD since it's so small,
right,
the lettering so small. But I think that's still important. So we have a really great package for the record, you know, all the lyrics and write-ups and pitches. So it's a really nice package.
That's good. I'm an old school guy, and I love picking up the physical stuff and opening it and leafing through the booklet. I got to put the readers on to read the booklet now, but I still, we all do it.
Well, in the old days, we had the record, and we also used that to get the seeds out of the pot.
Yes, I'm sure you guys, I'm sure you guys did.
Yeah, a little bit of that, yeah.
So, Barry, I definitely want to talk about all the work that you've done as a solo artist, but it's impossible to interview you without talking about Boston.
Sure.
I mean, and you're probably sick of talking about Boston, but since I've never asked you any questions about it, I'm a little bit excited about it.
No, you know, it's something I look back with, you know, it was just a tremendous time. It was everything we ever could have hoped it would be. You know, it took off so quickly and so big and the success that I'm so proud to have been part of it.
So in 1976, when this debut album comes out, how old of a gentleman are you at that point?
I was 26.
26. So not old, but not young, but I think that's a good age to hit success.
We had started putting together songs and doing demos for way back in 69, excuse me, which was the year that I graduated high school.
Wow.
That's the year that I met Tom Scholz. And we recorded and did demos for years, trying to get something going, till finally in 75, we get some real interest in, mm-hmm, you know, the record in 76. So it was a long time coming.
There were always, after years and years that the album was out, then I started to hear rumors that that the band photo on the back weren't really the guys that were on it. I would hear that it was just Tom and Brad, and then a drummer whose name is failing me.
But
then when the 2006 remaster came out, it kind of had the credits for each individual song. Is that the case? Are those 2006 credits accurate? It's always kind of a mystery to me.
Yes, those are accurate. Tom redid the credits. Obviously, he played the majority of the instruments on the first record, and he wanted people to know that. So that's part of why he redid the credits. But Sebastian played all the drums on the record except for one cut.
Right.
And the rest of us were on the record, but obviously Tom played the majority of the instruments on there.
You know, you get a nice credit on the song Long Time. It says lead guitar, and then in quotes it says monster guitar. I mean, that's a nice pat on the back.
He did give me a nod on that one.
Yeah. And then you play lead and rhythm on Let Me Take You Home Tonight.
Yeah, that's the song that Brad wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really kind of shy, but I get this feeling whenever you walk by. I don't want to down you, I want to make you high. If you could see your way to me, come on and let me try. Let me take you home tonight. I'll show you sweet delight.
I tell a story, I've told it on this show before, when I was in high school and I would be getting ready to go to a high school dance, that's the song I would listen to. Getting ready to go to the high school dance.
Hopes.
In the hopes. But who, I'm not bringing anyone home to my parents' house. But, you know, as a kid, that's the song that was a romantic song for me. So
we recorded that song out in California. Tom was back east re-recording the demos. And the rest of the band went out to L.A. And we actually recorded Let Me Take You Home Tonight without Tom. And he came in later and put some organ on it and worked with us on the recording the vocals.
Gotcha. It's still one of the best debut albums, if not the best debut album of all time. I mean, there's not a track you skip. It still sounds fresh today. You still wonder, how did they get this guitar sound? How did they get, you know, the whole package was amazing. The cover, I mean, you didn't go into this thing half-assed. It was quite a production. And
as far as the cover goes, I think we really lucked out on that one. Believe it or not, the first cover idea that the record label sent us was a head of lettuce. And we looked at it was like, we don't get it. What is it? They said, oh, it's Boston lettuce. Well, here in Boston, that's iceberg lettuce. So we had no idea.
Yeah,
that's not going to fly. That's not going to fly. And then they hired the fellow that did the artwork and came up with that idea. I was like,
yeah, the flying spaceship guitar. It's amazing. Ahead of lettuce. Yeah. I can't think of was the record company trying to tank this album immediately? That would have been terrible.
Well, I think they were kind of cheap out. Is probably the best description.
Yeah. Yeah. So 17 million albums sold. I imagine you have some platinum and gold records hanging up somewhere in your house.
I do. Yeah.
Did you just look up at one? It looked like you looked up at
one.
Yeah,
it's in my hallway.
That's quite an achievement for a kid who had a dream to, you know, play guitar, maybe have a career in music, and you finally achieve it. What age did you pick up the guitar and start playing?
Oh, I started early. I started when I was 11. You know, I had been asking to play guitar. My parents kept putting me off, thinking, you know, it was just something I was going through. So we borrowed an acoustic guitar from my babysitter. And I started taking lessons. And, you know, I really applied myself. My parents realized, well, you know, he's serious about this. And they bought me my first electric guitar, a 62 white Stratocaster.
Nice.
Which I wish I still had today. And I just went at it with gusto and joined my first band when I was 13. By the time I was 15, I was playing seven nights a week at the what they called the Combat Zone here in Boston, which was the adult area in town. And we played at a bar room that had go-go dancers in cages on either side of the band dancing.
Now, how were you able to get in there at 15, even though you were part of the band? Did they just think you were 18?
Yeah, well, they knew I wasn't 18. I was a little bitty thing, you know. I was a foot shorter than the other guys in the band. And the owner of the club was walking around with a cigar, and he'd look up at us and say, hey, quit looking at the girls, you know, because we're, you know, they're dancing next to us. We're like, hey.
Now, how does this fly with your parents? Or don't they know where you're playing?
Honestly, I look back on it. You know, I've got kids. My kids are grown now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I figure I was kind of a liberal parent, but I never would have let my kids do what my parents let me do. We were playing till 2 o'clock in the morning every night, coming home, and I'd get up in the morning and go to school. And then we did an afternoon show on Saturdays besides. Wow. But at the same time, I was making as much money as some of my kids' parents were, my friends' parents were making. So it was a really learning experience, because the other guitar player, he seemed to know every song there was. So everything we did was requests. So people would shout out a song title. He would look at us and say, key of E, 1, 2, 3, 4. And we just jumped in. So, I mean, for me, it was a real learning experience about, you know, being quick on your feet, so to speak.
So during the day, you're in high school. And then at night, this seems like your college.
College of rock and roll.
Yeah. So how were you keeping your grades up in high school, maintaining the schedule?
Yeah, you know, I did pretty good in high school. And, you know, after high school, I went to Boston University. And I was trying to really apply myself. I wasn't in a band. You know, I figured, you know, I was the first one to go to college in my family, and it was really important to everybody. But I met up with a high school friend that I had been in a band with, and he was across the river at MIT. And we thought, yeah, let's get a band together just for the fun of it. You know, he was at a fraternity house over in MIT. So we got together and just did cover tunes and played at the toga parties and whatever. And we decided to add a keyboard player. And I put an ad in the local paper, and Tom Scholz answered the ad. Of course, Tom had just graduated from MIT with a master's degree in 5 years and was out in the workforce in Polaroid. So for him, it was a comfortable situation. You know, it was MIT guys, it was a fraternity. So, you know, he was comfortable with it. And, you know, that's when we first met and started working together.
So Tom has this master's degree, but deep down, he wants to be a musician. He wants to be a rocker.
Yeah, at the time, he joined as a keyboard player. And a funny story, when he graduated from MIT, his parents said, well, what do you want for a graduation present? He said, well, I want a Hammond organ.
Wow.
But his parents didn't want him to play music, so they bought him a Jaguar.
So his family were upper class, it sounds like.
I had never been around a Jaguar before.
No, I don't know.
Most of the guys at the fraternity house were, you know, fairly well to do. You know, they had muscle cars and all that kind of stuff that, you know, I didn't have. I kind of grew up in a middle class family. Yeah. My dad had a auto body shop. So it was a lot of fun. And, you know, Tom started writing songs. The first thing we played of his was what would later become Foreplay. He had written that as kind of a classical piece. So that's really the first original piece we started to play.
And you have rhythm guitar credit on Foreplay on the Boston debut.
On the record, sure.
It's funny too, when this album came out, my brother purchased it. He's 6 years older than me. I was 12 and I'm listening to this. Foreplay, I don't even know what that word means. I just thought it meant, well, this is the piece of music that plays before
the other one.
Yeah. Before a long time. So I didn't know for until
well,
I got
that too.
Yeah. That well, that too. But, the actual, term Foreplay, that was lost on me. So when you guys first go out and tour on the debut Boston album, are you guys, I imagine you only have 8 songs. Are you're playing this probably the entire album every night?
Well, you know, we hadn't really done many shows before. So, you know, the first dates they had booked for us were all like nightclubs and, you know, small venues.
Yeah.
So the first shows were out in the Midwest playing nightclubs. And, you know, we didn't have the equipment we needed. We didn't have people we needed. We actually went out and bought most of the equipment from used listings.
Okay.
You know, Sub had a van. We'd go up and buy, you know, used Marshall stack, throw it in the back. And the people that we hired were just, you know, when we had a rehearsal place, you know, anybody that does lights, oh, this guy does lights. Hey, okay, you're all lighting guy, you know.
Wow. So catch as catch can.
It took a while to come together. So we're in the Midwest and we're doing these nightclub dates. And of course, the record took off immediately. So we had lines around the block waiting to get in these places. And if you think about it, the first Boston record is only 38 minutes long.
Yeah.
So, you know, we really had to stretch.
You got to fill it out. There's some guitar solos and keyboard solos happening.
Our initial set, you know, we could do like an hour and that was pretty much it.
But yeah.
Everybody loved the music so much that, you know, nobody seemed to complain about it.
Were you able to replicate that music live? Because, you know, it's a true studio album. There are some things and sounds on that album that I would imagine might be hard to replicate in a live setting. Were you guys able to do it?
Well, I got a great story for that. The first date we did in an arena was in the Providence Civic Center. And it was in the fall of 76. The record had only been out for 3-4 months at that point. And we were opening for Jeff Beck.
Okay.
And we'd never played an arena before. We were actually auditioning a sound man. So everything sounded great on stage, but out in the audience, people were looking at us like, what's going on? There'd be drums, there'd be a singer, there'd be, you know.
Yeah.
It was a mess. And I'm playing. Of course, I'm nervous. It's our first show on a really big stage. And I look over to my side, and there's Jeff Beck and Joe Perry standing there with the arms crossed.
Oh, like, my God.
So after the show, we went back, we met Jeff, and of course, he was on the same label as us, Epic Records.
Yeah.
And Jeff said, you know, I've heard your record, and I didn't think you guys were going to be able to do it live, but it sounded great, just like the record. I was like,
wow. You can't,
thank God.
You can't Jeff get a better compliment. Yeah.
Just like the record.
And Boston's a guitar driven and Jeff Beck is a guitarist, but how did you go over with his audience? Cause they're probably there to see Jeff. Did you guys go over okay?
We did really well.
Excellent.
With all the acts we played with, our first major tour was opening up for Black Sabbath. And that would seem like an odd pairing, but we did really, really well. The crowd loved us and Black Sabbath loved this too, because, you know, we were on the way up. Black Sabbath at that point was kind of fading off. So we were selling a lot of tickets and they appreciated that fact. And we got along with those guys great. In fact, Sib and I went to Black Sabbath shows for years and years after that and still saw the guys and kept in touch. And,
oh, that's excellent.
Yeah, you know, we had some great, great times with those guys.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, you guys are on the way up. So people are coming to see you too. The seats are being filled by Boston fans. And again, I don't know anyone that didn't know that own that album when I was a kid. Everyone, it was everywhere. It was like Fleetwood Mac Rumors would become. I mean, it's just one of those albums that everyone owns. When did you guys start headlining with the second album, or did you do some headlining shows with debut?
No, we were headlining literally 6 months after the record came out. Like I said, we started doing club work for the first couple of months. And then we did a couple of months with Black Sabbath. And then when we got into early 77, which is, you know, 6 months after the record came out, we were headlining. And again, you know, the album was only 38 minutes long.
How do you
we're
feel?
We're in an arena now. We're the headlining act. So we were really starting to stretch it. And,
were you adding any?
At that point, we had some other songs that, you know, eventually ended up on the second record. So
so you could put those.
Still, our headlining show was only about 55 minutes at that point.
Yeah, well, I mean, unless you do a couple covers, the audience knows coming in that, well, they've got the eight songs, so that's what we're going to hear. So, but if you're killing it, then, you know, doesn't matter if it's a short show.
I don't remember anybody complaining that they didn't get enough. So
it had to be longer than a Ramones show. So,
well, their songs are only 2 minutes long.
Yeah, so. And they were playing 30 songs in the time you guys were playing eight. Here's what always has been a bummer for me as a fan. You guys were probably obviously recording some of these live shows, but we've never, that classic lineup of you five guys, we've never got like a live album from back in the day. Do you know if anything like that exists? I guess Tom is in charge of all things
the,
Boston.
The only live recording that really exists is the King Biscuit Flower Hour. We did one show for them that's still circulating around. And since then, a show we did at the Giant Stadium came up on what's it called?
YouTube?
Wolfgang's Vault.
Oh, okay. Wolfgang's Vault.
Wolfgang's Vault, Vault. All right. Came up with that show, and it's a complete show in Giant Stadium.
Wow.
It's worth looking at. It's, you know, I would say that's at our height of our career.
That's the height. I'll have to check that out because I know Wolfgang's Vault, but I haven't seen it. But I guess I was referring to, I can't believe that Epic and Columbia haven't tried to, you know, release.
Well, you know, we did
official
record quite a few shows, and, you know, there was talk of there being a live album, but, you know, I think, you know, Tom likes things to be perfect, and live shows are never perfect. So, you know, it never happened.
No. I want to hear some mistakes when I see a live show. Like if I buy a live album, I want it to really be live. I mean, if someone played something off, I want to hear that. I hate when they tweak it after the fact, but you know, what are you going to do?
Well, it's like seeing the Eagles. It's so perfect.
It's so almost, perfect. Yeah.
You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's what they want. So I guess, you know, more power to them. When you're part of a band that sells, I don't know what the two albums together, 30 million copies or so. How does that, and I hope this isn't too personal of a question, how does that equate to dollars for you? Like, can you live comfortably because of those two records, you yourself?
Yes. Life is good.
Okay.
Life is good. You know, I didn't have any interest in the publishing of either of the records. So.
Right.
I get artist royalties from the records, and of course I made the money we made from the touring.
Sure.
When I was with the band. But you know, I've had a bunch of other projects since then, and
sure,
kept busy. So.
And we're going to talk about those. I do want to talk a little bit about Don't Look Back, and then we'll move on. With Don't Look Back, is the tour bigger now? Is there more staging, more lighting? You guys get more money from the label?
Getting money from the label is always a problem. Yeah, we did have a bigger production. You know, that's all the band generates, all that stuff. You know, by the time we got to the second record, the label wasn't really, you know, supporting the tour. So the tour supported themselves.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's how.
So, you know, by the second record, we were doing stadiums. We went out and did we did the Superdome. We did the Giant Stadium. We did the Tangerine Bowl, Anaheim Stadium.
Wow.
Played the stadium up in San Francisco. So it was on a whole bigger scale at that point.
I mean, that must be a dream come true for you. Like you walk out on stage and you see that many people. It's like something you can't even describe to someone that's never done it before.
Well, I remember the Superdome really well because the stage was so high up. You know, there was a stairway going up the stage. And of course, at that point, I was wearing, you know, the platform shoes.
Sure.
And outfit and the whole thing, and, you know, walking to just let me make it to the top here. And then you get to the stage and it's like literally a couple of stories down. So, you know, obviously if you fell off the stage, you're dead. And looking out at, you know, 88,000 people we had at that show was just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Mind-boggling.
That's incredible. The credits for you for Don't Look Back, lead guitar on Don't Look Back. Amazing. A great song. I have to be honest. I do love this album as much as the first album. They're such a nice companion piece. Like, you can just play these things back to back seamlessly. Everything's great. You also play lead guitar on Used to Bad News and Don't Be Afraid. Are all great songs. So thank you as a fan, Barry, because these songs are just killer. And again, you sell 7 million albums, which is, you know, that's no small feat. Usually an album has a sophomore slump. 7 million albums is not a slump in the least.
Well, you know, a lot of people said, oh, well, you know, the second record didn't do nearly as good as the first one.
Well, but, I mean,
you know, if we had sold 7 million on the first one and, you know, 3 million on the second, that would have been a whole different deal.
Right, right. But look, no one has a debut like Boston that sells that mind-boggling amount of albums. So 7 yeah. million is solid for sure.
Well, I think we were the best-selling debut until I think Guns N' Roses.
Well, that's a long time. And I think the album celebrates, it's going to be 45 years old this year, 2021.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
Incredible.
You know, I think part of the reason it sold so many records also is all the different formats it went through. Mm-hmm. You know, when it first came out, people were still using 8-tracks.
Yeah.
And then and they're using cassettes after that, and then the cassettes went to CDs.
And then you had to remaster the CD and release it again.
So, you know, we went through all those different formats, and people that liked the record had to have it in the other format. So I think that probably led to part of why we sold so much.
Also, I believe those first two albums were albums that guys liked and girls also liked them. I mean, they're
a good point, because when we opened for Black Sabbath, it was a largely male audience. I think there are probably more women there for the opening act.
Absolutely. Yeah, because these, you know, Black Sabbath doesn't have a ballad, but you guys had some great... some great crossover songs for men and women, if we're going to pigeonhole it like that. But
right.
All right, here we go. 1980, the Barry Goudreau solo album. I've always wanted to ask about this album because to me, I just didn't even understand how it even exists. And here's the reason. First of all, I remember going into the record store in 1980 and seeing that this on the shelf. I think there might have only been one or two copies in the record store. And the hype sticker probably said featuring members of Boston, you know, because your band, you guys were kind of not known. You were known as Boston. No one really knew the individual names of the individual players. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yes.
And no disrespect, no slight to you guys.
Oh, yeah.
So I see that hype sticker and I'm like, oh, okay. So I buy that album. I bring it home. I open it up. And then inside I see you and Brad and Sib. Now, Sib especially jumps out at me because of the hair and the look. And I was like, oh, there's three guys from Boston on this album. The singer's on this album. Well, then I dropped the needle on this thing. And I mean, from the opening track and the opening riff of Hard Luck, to me, it's a Boston album. I mean, it's, and then I started to tell people about this. I'm like, you got to hear this album. It's like the third Boston album. People wouldn't even know what I was talking about. I'd have to play it for them in my bedroom. This album, I love it. It's such a killer album. But the questions I have are, first of all, how did you get a deal, Barry? Because if Brad got a deal, I would understand that. He's the singer from Boston. So he gets the deal. Yeah. How did you go about getting a solo album deal?
Well, this is how it went. The last tour I did with Boston was a tour of Europe in the fall of 79. So when we got into 1980, Tom brought the band together and said, I'm going to take this year off.
Okay.
I'm not going to record anything this year. If you guys want to do something else, you know, work with another act or do your own record, now would be the time to do it. And, you know, I had written a few songs early on in the Boston days that we did demos of, but none of them made the record. So I thought, well, yeah, maybe I'll try that. And I wrote the first song for it, which was Dreams, which ended up to be the first release.
Lost in a land of luxury, living out all your fantasies. I've been down since you went away. It wasn't love, but it felt okay. My head is numb, I've been up all night. I'll soon be seeing the morning light. Can't explain what I feel inside. I wanna run and I wanna hide. My shining hope's on the telephone line. I hope you're picking it up this time. It's only dreams that I hold on to. Dreams are all that I have with you. Memories and dreams of love. Days I had with you. I never thought it'd be so tough to feel the way I do. Only you.
And I had the song together, so, you know, I'm not really a lead singer. So he said, Brad, why don't you come over and sing this for me? Brad came over and sang the song. Of course, you know, Sib Ashton, the drummer, and I had been friends and bandmates since high school. So if I was going to have somebody play drums, it was Sib, because right. I saw Sib every day anyway, you know. So Sid played drums on it and Brad sang it. And you know, Brad enjoyed doing it. And I had some other song ideas and I gave them to Brad and he wrote some lyrics for them. And, you know, we started to have several songs together and we were getting excited about it. So we brought the songs to Tom and played them for him. Said, you know, this is what we've been working on. What do you think? And Tom surprised us by saying, well, I'd like to produce it.
Okay.
Of course, we had hoped that he would say, I really like that song. I'll consider it for a Boston record. You know, that was our hope.
Yeah, because at this point, you're all in on Boston. You guys just want to keep going.
Right, right. And we realized that the record label wouldn't want Tom working on another record. They would want him working on a Boston record. So we continued working on the record. And I realized, well, if I'm going to put this out, you know, with Brad and Sib, it's, you know, it's too Boston-like. So I need to get another element in here. So I was introduced to Fran Cosmo through one of our crew members. So, you know, the singer is great, great voice, great guy. So we brought Fran in and he had written a few songs. We recorded his songs and it worked out really well. So at that point, I brought it to the record label to see what they thought of it. And they said, you know, we love it. Let's put it out. So we did.
That's and, how it was.
Know, the whole idea was to get the record done, get it out, you know, do some promotion on it, maybe a few shows or whatever. We get that all in that time, year-long time frame that we had gotten. Well, when the album came out, it was probably the sticker you were talking about. There was a sticker on the record. 6 million people have heard the sound of his guitar. Let us introduce you to its owner.
Okay.
And to me, that was saying, well, here's the guy that you don't know about. Here's the other guy we want to introduce you to.
Yeah.
Well, Tom took that as, here's the guy behind Boston.
Gotcha.
And he was not happy about it. So...
And I can see both sides of this. I can see how that's, I can get it. I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. And so obviously there was an issue there. He complained to the record label. The record label, you know, kind of pulled back on the promoting of the record and it died, you know, fairly quick death.
Yeah.
Tom got us back together at the beginning of 81. And because of the records, said, okay, I'm done. Barry's out. I'm not going to work with him anymore.
So first of all, the label could have just changed that sticker to say something else and kept promoting the record. Second, Tom gave you the go-ahead to do it. And then,
yeah, true.
Then you
true.
Do it. And then he's mad about it. That's sad.
Well, you know, hindsight being 2020, I wouldn't have tried to get it in that year long time frame. You know, I saw it as just something else I was doing outside of Boston. If I had been looking at it like this is going to be my career, I would have taken a whole different approach to it.
So. Right. Well,
but, you know, I think it's a good record. I mean, to me, it doesn't sound like it's completely formed yet, I guess would be one way to put it. But, you know, I'm still proud of it.
I mean, Barry, I love this record and I don't know, I guess maybe because when it came out, I wanted another Boston record so badly and there wasn't one. So this was, and I'm not going to say the next best thing. This was for me just as good. I mean, I
appreciate that.
I love Fran. I like Fran's three songs too. I kind of thought maybe he was brought in because maybe Brad wasn't allowed to do the entire album because then it would be too close to Boston, but you've cleared that up.
No, I think Brad would have been happy singing the whole record. I mean, he just enjoyed, you know, writing songs and recording, and you know, we had a ball doing it.
But the guitar sound on the album, on many of the tracks, is the guitar sound that I hear as a non-musician on Boston albums. So that did beg the question for me as a listener, how much of the Boston sound is Barry Goudreau and how much of it is Tom Scholz? Or is it so intertwined because you guys have known each other for so long? You just guys have like similar styles because.
Yeah. Well, I think it, you know, he learned a lot from me. I learned a lot from him. Like I said, when we first met, he was mostly a keyboard player and he was starting to play guitar and, you know, he picked it up really quickly. And, you know, I think a lot of his style is similar to mine, but then, you know, he developed so quickly. I picked up a lot from him as well. So, you know, worked in both directions.
Well, the two songs that you wrote on this album by yourself, which are Dreams and Sailing Away, those are terrific songs. You know, What's a Fella to Do? Is that, again, that's got that Boston guitar sound that I love so much. Yeah. Yeah, it's sad that this album didn't get its due, but it has been re-released a couple times. Razor and Ty released it on CD, and then Rock Candy Records.
Rock Candy, yeah.
Yeah, they've picked up the Barry Goudreau album, Orion the Hunter, and RTZ. So people, you can still get those albums. So go get them. I also want to say, you know, because we're talking about Brad and Sib, I want to say, you know, we say on the show, we say rock in peace because you did lose, you know, two of your, you know, great friends and collaborators. So, you know.
Well, some people may not realize, but Brad was also my brother-in-law.
I did not know that.
Yeah. My wife and his wife were his sisters.
Yeah. So see that. So family. So he's really
so,
family.
Yeah. We were families. Were very close. And, like I said, with Sib and I were friends since I was 15, and we stayed friends. I saw him pretty much every day right up until his death.
And just as a strange little bit of trivia for people, Sib, his son-in-law, is Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
He is, yeah.
Because I was watching an episode of, I think, Ballers, the HBO show. And at the end, it had like, it said for Sib, how do you say Sib's last name? I want to get it right.
Ashen.
And his name came up and I was like, well, I know that name. That's the drummer from Boston. So I, you know, I had to pull out the phone, do a quick Google. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. So that's,
well, he used part of Dreams on that show too.
Yes, you're right. That's what it was.
Yeah. He wanted something that Sib had played on that wasn't Boston, and that was pretty much.
That was the Barry Goudreau album, right?
Yeah.
All right, we're moving on to 19.
Just one quick note.
Absolutely.
they're doing a documentary on Sib called Let There Be Drums. And it's just starting to film it now. And of course, I'm going to be one of the talking heads in the movie. And Dwayne is committed to being involved as well. And my new Engine Room record is going to be featured in the movie as well. So
fantastic. That's great. Yeah, that's excellent. So in 1984, Orion the Hunter. Now, is the band called Orion and the album's called The Hunter, or is it the band is Orion the Hunter?
Well, you know, I wanted the band to be Orion.
Okay.
And it turns out that there was an artist in Nashville who had the rights to Orion. Never heard of him before. I never heard of him since.
Yeah.
But he had the rights to the name. So the record label said, well, why don't we call it Orion the Hunter? And I thought, well, okay, we'll call it Orion the Hunter. And most people will just call it Orion anyway.
Yeah.
Of course, it didn't turn out that way.
No, but Orion the Hunter was what we called it. Now this, you got, now Fran Cosmo is on lead vocals on this album. Cause I assume Brad is now enmeshed in whatever's happening with Boston recording. Whatever's happening with, I mean, Boston is dormant for years. And
well, Tom was working on the third stage record at that point. And Brad had committed to singing on that record.
Yeah.
To me, it did seem like time to move on. And, you know, I worked with Fran. We got along great. And so, you know, we started working on the Orion the Hunter album. And Fran and I wrote most of the material for it. And Brad came in and did bits here and there, sang a little background, wrote some lyrics for me. And, you know, I think Brad would have been happy singing on much more of it, or even all of it, if I had let him. But, it seemed like it was time to, move on from that.
It's very incestuous with these two vocalists, Brad and Fran. Fran's in Boston then for the fourth album, and then Brad comes back. Then there's an album called Corporate America where Brad sings half of it and Fran sings half of it. That's kind of like what happened on the Barry Goudreau solo album. So it's
the crazy thing is, you know, Fran sang with me on Orion the Hunter. And then when I formed RTZ with Brad,
right?
Brad left Boston and Fran replaced Brad in Boston.
Yeah, it's just, hey, good for those guys.
Then after RTZ ended, Brad went back to Boston and Boston had Fran and Brad.
I know it's crazy. If you look at the family tree of Boston members, it's wild how it all.
Well, I guess I've been pretty good at picking out good lead singers. I guess that's what it comes down to.
There you go. You can't, and it's so funny because they're similar and yet so different. Those two voices.
To me, they're very much different, but other people say, oh, they sound exactly alike. I don't think
they sound alike, but there are.
I've been listening to them through headphones for years.
Your entire life, right? Okay, so Orion the Hunter, you got Bruce Smith on bass and Michael DeRozier, who was no longer in Heart at that point. So,
yeah, I met Michael. We did a bunch of shows with Heart over the years, and I knew he had left the band, so I got in touch with him to see if he would be interested. Of course, Heart was on the CBS Records as well, so it was kind of in-house too. And I flew him out, and he lived at my house here for 6 months or so, and we put the record together, and worked out really good.
And are you you've still remained a relationship with Columbia, Portrait, Epic, whatever umbrella you want to put it under, because they release Orion the Hunter. So do you do the same thing again? Do you write the songs and record them, then present them, or did you get the deal first?
No, we had a lot of the songs demoed out first. Mm-hmm. And I brought them to Lenny Pizzi, who was at the label at the time. And he handled Boston, when I was with Boston. And, he and I co-produced a record. I've kept in touch with Lenny through the years, too. In fact, I just spoke to him last week.
And Lenny Pizzi, a couple years after co-producing this album, he co-produces Cyndi Lauper's True Colors albums. Lauper. Yeah. So big success. And again, shout out to Rock Candy Records, who have re-released these Barry Goodrow albums, including Orion the Hunter. We finally can hear it. It sounds fantastic. It sounds so good. And Brad does some background vocals on the song All Those Years. And then you guys had some FM play with So You Ran, which is a great tune.
Yeah, you know, at this time, MTV was the thing.
Yeah.
You know, and we did a video for So You Ran, and, you know, we got some okay play at MTV, but we didn't really get into that, you know, high repeat. You know, they played it like twice a day, which really wasn't enough to break through.
So you ran, took the heart of a lonely man.
Went out and we toured. We did a tour opening for Aerosmith. Aerosmith was doing their Back in the Saddle tour, which was when all the original band members got back together.
Right.
But they weren't really together. Put it that way.
They were still a mess.
All together up here.
Right.
And wow, what a crazy tour that was. You know, they had stiffed people so many times that, you know, we'd come into a city and they wouldn't have sold any tickets because nobody would buy a ticket because they thought, you know, Aerosmith, they're not going to show up. And then the local radio station would say, Aerosmith is at the venue doing their sound check. And we would get a walk up and fill the room.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that was a really interesting tour.
Yeah. I mean, I can't think of a band that came back stronger than Aerosmith. Like they were really at the bottom. I never thought Aerosmith would come back, but bravo, they did. What, now they're a mess. What was it like for you on the road? Were you a drug guy, or were you just all about the music?
I mean, by the time of the Ryan the Hunter, I was married. I didn't have kids yet, but yeah. I was married, and you know, I was kicking back. I was never a big drug user.
Right.
The other guys in the band weren't into that at all. Michael DeRozier, you know, he worked out every day with weights and stuff. You know, and ate health food, and you know.
So the opposite of Aerosmith for sure, Michael DeRozier.
Yes. Yeah.
And in regard to the So You Ran video, I mean, this is really your first foray into a music video at this point.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it was, we shot it right here. And, I grew up in Lynn, Massachusetts, and, most of the video was shot in my hometown.
And no offense to you guys. You guys are fine looking gentlemen, but you're not Duran Duran at the point. So it is going to be hard to get some airplay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, the single did pretty well. I think we made it up to, 50 or something like that. But we never got to that point where we broke through with it.
Yeah, but it's a great album. I still I recommend this one too. I mean, you know, the songs are good, playing's good, everything's great. So
yeah.
Again, seek out Orion the Hunter. So then it's, you know, by my count, it's like 7 years until you have a new release. Doesn't mean you're not doing things, doesn't mean you're not writing, recording demos and all that. But your next album is RTZ,
yep.
Return to Zero. So again, the band is called RTZ and the album's Return to Zero.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And you got Bradley Delp back, your buddy.
Yeah,
working.
Actually, I started working on new material for the RTZ record. Of course, it wasn't called RTZ right. at that point. And I was working with another singer, Fergie Fredrickson.
Oh, who? Yes.
The band Toto.
Yes.
And great guy, you know, loved the guy. We did a bunch of demos and we actually did a showcase for John Colada. I'm sure you heard of John Colada.
Oh, I'm picturing him right now.
He was the guy behind Aerosmith's Return.
The long beard. Yeah.
Long beard. Yeah,
white suit.
With a really funny voice.
Right.
So anyway, we did a showcase for John Colada, and he said, you know what, I don't hear it. And, you know, we had been working on for months on it, and it was to the point where Fergie needed something. He needed to make money. Okay. And he said, you know what, this has been great, but, you know, I can't do it anymore. And he left. So I pulled Brad back into the fold again. I said, I got some songs here. You want to come over and sing some songs for me? And he did, and he enjoyed it. And you know, it just kind of coalesced, and we ended up doing a record for Warner Brothers.
Look, if your singer leaves and the guy that comes in to replace him is Bradley Delp, you're doing okay. That's not bad.
I got it. Brad is just was one of the best there ever was. I mean, you know, if he was sitting next to you and he was singing, it sounded like his voice was through all this different equipment and modulated and everything else, but it wasn't. It was just his voice was just beautiful.
Well, yeah. I was lucky enough to see him perform in one of the later incarnations of Boston, which was, you know, with just Tom and Brad. It was out here in LA at the Universal Amphitheater. And I'm so glad that I was at that show because he was on point, just so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like an angel. It really, I mean, I don't know what else to say. Just a fantastic vocalist. So Return to Zero, produced by Chris Lord-Alge, comes out in July of 1991, which if we know what happens with music very soon after this release, it gets all, you know, grunge comes in.
As they say, timing is everything.
Yeah. So you,
and if the RTZ record had come out a year earlier, or maybe even 6 months earlier, I think it would have been a whole different thing, but grunge just kicked us in the ass.
But what's funny to me is the single, Until Your Love Comes Back Around, I'm just looking at the date, it gets up to number 26 in March of 92.
Yeah.
So that means that the record label was still, they were still working the album for you. I mean.
Well, actually, there's a story there. That was actually the second single. The first okay. single was Face the Music.
I can't blame you. Nobody wants to be the fool. Face the music. It's all there in front of you. You can get it if you really try. You can get it if you don't ask why. Life you've gotten used to, you don't care about the things you're into. You can get it, cause it's everywhere. Temptation hides behind every stair. And when you get it, it makes you feel good. You don't regret it, but maybe you should just.
And, you know, we were working with Irving Azoff at that point. You know, it was on Giant Records. That was Irving's imprint on Warner Brothers.
He's the guy to work with. These are the people you want to work with.
Well, he came to us. He said, well, you know, we'll do a video. Here's directors, clips of three different directors, and pick one of these directors. Yeah. Well, we picked one. It was actually Bob Dylan's son. Ben, I think it was his first name.
Okay.
So, you know, we're all scheduled to do our first video, and we get a call that they've cut the budget on the video. And Dylan calls us and says, you know, I can't do everything I was going to do. You know, I don't know if we should go ahead. And we said, you know what, full speed ahead. We're going to go and we're going to do it anyway. So we went out and he had all these different setups. But he said, well, I got all this set up, but I'm not going to be able to use that. And I got all this, but I can't use that. So the video ended up being pretty much the band standing on this pedestal. And that was it. That was the video. And honestly, it sucked. You know? Yeah. So we sent it to Irving, and Irving says, oh, that video sucks. Why'd you pick that guy? It was, well, you gave us three choices. That's the one we picked, yeah. You know? So, you know, we went back and forth. We went back and forth. The song, you know, Face of Music was coming up in the charts. I think, again, it made it up into the, probably in the 50s. And he finally said, okay, I'll do another video. And we got another director. We went and did another video, which I thought came out really well.
Excellent.
But the song was dropping down on the charts. And again, you know, MTV only gave us minor airplay, minor, you know, video play. And it didn't happen. So move on. And, you know, we've been out on tour. We've, you know, done a bunch of shows and so forth. And a radio station in the Baltimore, Washington area starts playing Until Your Love Comes Back Around. And it catches on.
Wow.
And it's getting really good. It ends up being the number one song in that area.
But now I'm back out on the street. Been running so hard, trying to find a place where my baby might be staying. I just gotta see her face. I know there's lots of lonely people crying all.
So we go back to Irving, said, we got a number one song. You know, we need to do a video. Hemmed and hawed. You know, I did everything I said I was going to do. And, you know, you got to do it. So he found a woman up in Canada who would do a video on the cheap.
Okay.
And we went up to Canada and did the black and white video for Until Your Love Comes Back Around, which I thought came out fantastically well. I thought it was really great. But again, timing being everything,
yeah,
the song was starting to go down in the charts. And by the time the video came out, we didn't get a whole lot of airplay. It didn't happen.
Yeah. the video and the song have to be in sync with each other in order for everything to, the stars to align. Yeah. But still, I mean, you know, number, what did I say? Number 20, 26. That's,
yeah.
You know, I mean, at this point you are, you know, what, almost 20 years into your career and you're still, you know, able to have some chart success, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, how do you measure success? You know, right. If you measure it to 17 million records, you're going to lose every time.
Right. You can't compare everything with that because you're done.
Yeah. But if you compare it to, you know, most acts, you know, it's, you know, pretty successful.
But again, the RTZ album, it's excellent. It's got great production, great playing, guitar, vocals, the songs are there. It's a really, really stellar album. So
yeah, thank you.
Another one I want people to go, I want people to listen to this, Barry, and then go and buy these records all over again or for the first time. That's what the goal always is of this show.
They're fantastic. Well, you know, I'm still working with those guys. Like I said before, Brian, I'm working with Brian Mace. He's singing lead and playing keyboards in my band. He joined as the keyboard player in Ryan the Hunter back when we went out on tour for the first time. And then he was the keyboard player in RTZ as well. And Tim Archibald played bass in RTZ, and he is a member of the new band as well. So I've stuck with those guys ever since the early 90s.
Well, again, I like that you formed this brotherhood of sorts with these musicians you've worked with all over the years. I think that's fantastic. And I wish you continued success and great success with the new project. And what about a Barry Goodreau book? Have you ever thought about writing all these? It sounds like you have a bunch of stories that we only touched the surface on today.
Well, I've got a story there too.
Can we hear that one?
I actually did write a book. You know, I was thinking about it at one point, so I wrote a couple of chapters. And one of my wife's girlfriends says, gee, I know this woman who's a successful writer. And it turns out that this woman had a couple of best-selling books. So okay. I went to her and I said, you know, I'm thinking about writing a book. And she said, what do you got? And I gave her what I had written. She says, yeah, I'll do this. And we ended up putting a whole book together. And we went to publishers to publish the book. And I said, you know, a little worried that there might be some legal issues with this, you know. And she said, well, don't worry, you know, the publishers will indemnify you against any lawsuits. So we shopped the book and you know, the publishers liked the book. They said, yeah, we like the book. You know, we'll put it out, but you have to indemnify us. Oh. I said, no, I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
So, I have a book on a disc here, and
someday maybe.
I don't think anybody's ever going to see it.
Yeah. Well, look, I, as a fan, I hope someday we do get to read that, and that's a lot of hard work to put in to something that's going to sit on the shelf. So,
well, you know what? It was actually a really, really good experience for me. I literally put a whole year into it, and. You know, looking back over my life and also just the skill of, you know, putting it together. She was a super editor. You know, I did all the writing. She did the editing. I mean, it was really a great experience, even if only a handful of people ever see it.
Probably therapeutic. You probably maybe worked through some things that maybe were bothering you all these years.
Yeah.
Just to put them out on paper.
I finished the book right after, Brad's death. Mm-hmm. So the book ended with Brad's death.
And yeah.
Obviously, since then, a lot more has happened. You know, obviously, Sib's death since then.
Yeah.
So if I were ever to do it, obviously, I have to go back and amend it.
Right. Well, I look forward to you in the Sib documentary when that comes out. That'll be nice.
Yeah, it's. I think it's really gonna be great. The people involved have done several documentaries before that were really good. So you know, have really high hopes for it.
Very cool. There's nothing like a great rock doc. Everyone likes them. Now, before we go, I just want to tell people you can go to barrygoudreau.com. You and Barry, you have a Twitter account, but you're not really active on Twitter. Is that fair to say?
No, I'm not. I've got somebody working with the Facebook account, and we're becoming more active with that. There's also another website. I've got the barrygoudreau.com, but there's also barrygoudreau'sengineroom.com.
Oh, okay, good, good, good.
If you go to one, it'll send you to the other. But
all right,
you know, there's some the video up there, and you'll be able to access the music through there as well.
Perfect. And I would like you to suggest what our playout song for this episode would be. What Barry Goudreau song from your entire career, new, old, whatever, would you like me to play out? I know it's tough.
It is tough, but I would rather look forward than look back. So let's put The Road, the song I sent you today.
All right. This is brand new Barry Goudreau music. Please enjoy The Road. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you. It's been great.
We were driving down to Texas on a smoky, dusty road. We fell asleep in Texas. I was in Texas when I woke. She sang me a song. It was so sweet. It was the road. Played my guitar in Mississippi, and I opened up my case. She handed me a silver dollar, and her hand caressed my face. She sang me a song. So sweet, it was the road. It was the road that set me free, and then she laid her chains on me. It was the road that made me whole, that she took pieces of my soul. Outside my window, shouting my name into the night, singing about things that only she could know. She was the road. We had to make our way up north, up to Presque Isle at harvest time. When the band began to play, all the people sang in time. They sang us a song. It was so sweet. It was the road. It was the road that set me free. And then she laid a chain. It was the road that made me whole, that she took pieces of my soul. She danced outside my window, shouting my name into the night, singing about things that only she could know. She was the road.
Boston, you're all waiting there.